final case for this afternoon is case number 57489, Halpin versus Edge Group LLC. Jennifer Dorsey, counsel for the appellants. Robin Schumacher, counsel for respondent. Justice Perrier will not participate in this this case. You guys can be seated. Ms. Dorsey, you're ready to proceed.
Thank you. Chief Justice Chair, may it please the Court. Good afternoon. I'm Jenny Dorsey, and I represent the appellants in this case, Jason Halpern and JLH Vegas. Mr. Halpern is here with me today, and he wanted me to express his gratitude to this Court for allowing us the opportunity and the privilege to argue this to the Court en banc today. I'm going to attempt to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This is a complicated case that lends itself to a simple result because this Court has already decided the rule twice. Unfortunately, the District Court did not appreciate its application and entered summary judgment on liability in favor of Edge based on a twice rejected principle of law. That entry of summary judgment then snowballed into additional orders and judgments and post-judgment awards, all of which need to be reversed and remanded back to the District Court based on this ruling. A little bit of background. When the Edge Group was sued for intentional and negligent torts, it sought indemnity from Mr. Halpern and other members of the Foch Group based on a general indemnity agreement in a settlement agreement, and it refused to tender its defense. Days before the final summary judgment hearing in the District Court on liability, this Court handed down its decision in George Brown Insurance Agency versus Star Insurance Company and held that contracts purporting to indemnify a party against that party's own negligence will be enforced only if they clearly express such an intent, and a general provision indemnifying the indemnity against all claims standing alone is not sufficient. The District Court considered Brown, but it rejected it as nothing more than an insurance case that had no application outside of the insurance context. And instead, the Court applied the very rule that this Court rejected in Brown, that all claims means all claims, including claims arising out of the indemnity's own negligence. That linchpin ruling erroneously shifted a nearly $2 million indemnity judgment in settlement payment and attorney's fees and costs to the Halpern parties. And it must be reversed for three reasons. First, because the indemnity clause does not expressly state that it covers Edge's legally culpable conduct, it was not triggered by the lawsuit, and Halpern has no obligation to indemnify or defend Edge. Second, at a minimum, the District Court was required to conduct a hearing on Edge's culpability, as alleged in the Roche lawsuit, before enforcing the indemnity clause, as this Court held in Brown and also in Rayburn. And third, Edge's refusal to tender control over its defense to the Foch Group absolved Halpern of any indemnity obligation in this case. Now, although there are several other errors that we've identified in our briefs because of our time limitations here, and because these three issues are entirely dispositive of the case, I'm only going to address those in this argument. As to the first point, in Brown, this Court adopted the majority rule of indemnity clause interpretation, that contracts purporting to indemnify a party against its own negligence will only be enforced if they clearly express such an intent, and a general provision indemnifying the indemnity against any and all claims standing alone is not sufficient. The Brown rule is based in part on the express negligence doctrine, and the express negligence doctrine provides that a party demanding indemnity from the consequences of its own negligence or wrongdoing must express that intent in specific terms within the four corners of the contract. That rule was reiterated, that Brown rule was reiterated several months later by this court when it handed down its ruling in the Rayburn landscaping case, in which the same panel further held that a duty to defend and indemnify only covers those claims alleging negligence of the indemnitor, and it does not extend to claims alleging the indemnity's own negligence. Like the indemnity agreements in Brown and Rayburn, the one here between Edge and the Foch Group is one of general application, indemnifying Edge, same exact language, from and against any and all claims by a certain group of claimants. It does not contain an express intent that Edge be indemnified against its own negligence or any other misconduct of its own. In fact, it is entirely silent on that point, just like the indemnification clauses found in the Brown case and in the Rayburn case. But nevertheless, this is the very clause on which Edge claimed and the district court found coverage for the lawsuit against Edge, which alleges only intentional torts and negligent torts against Edge. So I think that's a critical thing to remember, is that the lawsuit that it was seeking indemnity from only has about four claims. The first three are intentional torts, and the last one is negligence. And its entire position in this case was that this general indemnity agreement was intended, even though it's entirely silent in this regard, intended to force my clients to pay for the settlement and the defense and the litigation expenses associated with Edge's defense of those intentional and negligence claims. Now, the Brown decision is obviously critical to this case because it articulates the rule that controls the very linchpin question in this case of whether the Foch Group had a duty to indemnify Edge for this lawsuit. The district court refused to apply Brown and instead followed the Brown-rejected minority rule approach to hold that the general indemnification provision containing any and all claims necessarily must include these negligence and intentional torts because there was no limitation on them. Again, that's the exact rule that this court rejected by the Brown decision and later reaffirmed several months later in the Rayburn case. Now, the district court simplistically concluded that Brown only applied to in the insurance context. And in this jurisdiction, when you say, oh, this is an insurance case, it sort of is a buzzword. It triggers some thoughts. And typically what that means is that it's an insurance policy case because this court has articulated very different rules applying to certain insurance policies than other types of contracts because of the nature of insurance policies. But the important thing here is that in the Brown case, there wasn't an insurance policy. This wasn't an insurance policy. This was a general commercial contract, just like this one. In the Brown case, it was a producer agreement between the insurance company and the insurance broker. And so it was just a garden variety insurance contract. And so the fact that it arose in the insurance contract, in the insurance context, didn't distinguish it in any way that should have led the district court to ignore it in this case. That's exactly what happened. In their answering brief, Edge claims that Brown and Rayburn don't apply because those contracts were services contracts. And this isn't a services contract, this is a settlement agreement that this indemnity provision is contained in. Again, this is a distinction without a difference. First, neither in Brown nor in Rayburn did this court say anything about the intention to limit this indemnity rule to the facts of Brown or Rayburn. Instead, this is a rule of general contract construction. In fact, those are the buzzwords that are used by Justice Foley in the 1980 case where he discussed the two different approaches, the majority and the minority approach in the Aetna case. And essentially, he makes it very clear that it's a question of whether this court is going to apply this general rule of contract construction. And in Brown and in Rayburn, this court said, we will apply it and we're going to use the majority approach. Unfortunately, it was the minority approach that the district court used here, and that is why this must be reversed. And finally, the cases that this court relied on in both Brown and Rayburn indicate that the rule applies generally to various types of agreements, because the two main cases it relied on, the economy forms case, was a lease agreement for concrete forms used in construction. And then the other case, the Lehman case, actually considered an indemnity clause in a settlement agreement just like here. So it's very clear from both Brown, Rayburn, and all of the cases that those two cases rely on, that this is a rule of general application and it should not have been limited in its applicability by the district court here.
Would your analysis be different if the claims by the third party had already been filed at the time the settlement agreement was reached? In other words, would the reference have been enough if those claims were on file by those named parties?
I think the answer is no, because the contract provision, the indemnification provision, is silent as to when these claims must arise in order to be covered. So I just don't think it makes a difference here.
So even if those were fully on file, the exact same four claims, three intentional, one negligent, already on file and asserted, that, as a point of reference, would not have gotten past the express negligence rule?
That would not have, unless it were referenced by case, possibly.
Right.
In this, I think if it were referenced by case, I think that you could get it under the express negligence rule. I think you could also get it under the restatement approach.
Right.
I think it would actually be more reasonable under the restatement approach because that would more likely do what the parties had intended to cover. But again, we don't have that.
Just a point of clarification, there was no such suit on file at the time the settlement agreement was reached.
That's right.
And there had been no demand letter. There's nothing like that in the record.
That's right.
Thank you.
That's right. And again, it wouldn't matter because the agreement doesn't talk about timing one, and secondly, there's certainly no reference to such a lawsuit, which may have been enough, but there's no reference regardless. So I think it's very clear that Brown and Rayburn provide the very rule that this court the very rule that the district court should have applied in this case, and because the district court failed to appreciate that and actually recognize that Brown applied, we have to reverse and we have to go all the way back to the beginning, because that was the basis on which the court entered summary judgment on liability. And so all of the other agreements, or all of the other judgments and orders, all flowed from that. I'm going
to see. Is there any reason to believe that where an indemnity clause lists the names of potential claimants, that the analysis would change?
There is not. And the reason that there is not is because the names of the potential claimant is not the focus of the express negligence rule or the restatement approach. The focus is the names of the claims, not the claimants, essentially. And so what you have to look to is whether or not this talks about the types of claims that are going to be covered. That's what the express negligence rule holds. That's what the restatement approach holds. And this simply doesn't. So identifying the claimants is irrelevant. In Rayburn, this court even held that saying it doesn't cover sole negligence wasn't enough. So there was additional clarification in the Rayburn case that this court even held wasn't close enough, because it didn't talk about what was covered, it just talked about what wasn't covered. So the focus is on claims, not claimants, so that doesn't make a difference. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
About a minute and 36 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice Cherry, members of the court. Let me address a few of the points that were made by counsel and then get into what I consider to be the more pertinent points in their argument. First, addressing the tender defense issue. Judge Kadish at the trial court level interpreted the unambiguous provisions in the settlement agreement that contains the indemnity provision that's at issue today. Both parties agreed and represented in their pleadings and at the trial that that agreement was unambiguous. Nowhere in that agreement is there any obligation on the part of respondents to tender the defense or even notify anyone of any of the claims that were to be identified. In fact, the word tender nowhere appears anywhere in that agreement, and where there is an unambiguous agreement, the court at the trial court level was obligated to look within the four corners and not supplant terms and conditions that the trial judge thought might be more convenient or even reasonable. So Judge Kadish got that decision right. The parties, through an arm's-length transaction, entered into a settlement agreement. Nowhere in that agreement was there any obligation to tender. Next, we turn to the representation that Judge Kadish determined that Brown did not apply. More accurately, what Judge Kadish did was remark that this court in the Brown decision indicated that it was interpreting an insurance contract.
I have to differ with you on that. I think they were interpreting an insurance producer contract. It would not, there can be all manner of production of contracts. I don't think the stripiece of the Brown case, in fairness, is the insurance setting in which that employment relationship arose.
I agree. And that an insurance contract is to be distinguished, at least in my mind, from an insurance policy. My point is more specifically this, though, for purposes of this discussion. Judge Kadish said even if Brown were to apply, it would not bar the type of indemnity that was requested because the parties to that arm's-length transaction identified with specificity the specific type of claims in terms of the claimant. It identified, among others, the appellant as the claimants. And so, whereas you had an insurance services contract that had the indemnitor agreeing to provide future services to an insurance company, and that the indemnity obligation arose out of the provision of those prospective services, this situation was different. There were prior dealings specifically between the co-developers of the proposed W Hotel and Casino project. This indemnity agreement was looking backwards in time, retrospectively, if you will, to business dealings between, among others, the appellant and the respondent, along with the Roche entities. And so there were this finite group of claims that arose out of that transaction, if you will, those business dealings to try and get the W Hotel Casino off the ground.
Because the die were cast at that point, that was the material distinction between your case and Brown and Rayburn?
It was one of the material.
Do you have any authorities that distinguish the express negligence rule on that basis?
No, not yet.
Mr. Schumacher, again, explain to me why there would not be a genuine issue of material fact in the liability portion of the case as to the past dealings between the parties and their intent. You know, you're just saying based on the document the court could read it and conclude as a matter of law that this is what the parties intended, or would there be potentially an issue of fact there?
The parties took the position at the trial court that the agreement was unambiguous. If that were not the case, then extrinsic evidence would have been appropriate and there would have been, by definition, a tribal issue of fact. But both parties took the position the agreement is unambiguous. There were just differing perspectives on how to interpret the unambiguous.
So they asked the court to make a legal determination on that on the liability phase of the case.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Halpern's 56F motion didn't ask for time to examine liability?
There were two separate Rule 56F motions, or if I don't remember accurately, there were two components to a Rule 56F motion, one of which was denied, and the basis ensured for that denial was that the case had been ongoing for a long period of time. We had been to the Discovery Commissioner, Bonnie Brewer, a number of times, and Judge Gatish found that relative to those issues, the appellant essentially had slept on its rights, or his rights. As to the damages portion, the court did grant the 56F motion, giving additional time to do that discovery. One other important point was, and the district court noted this in the decision on the 56F component of the cross motions for summary judgment, that Judge Kadish had granted two extensions of the discovery cutoff during the normal course of that case prior to trial, and during that period of time, the appellant did not avail itself of the opportunity to go get that information. So essentially the court latches, if you will, the appellant had slept on his rights, had been given the opportunity to get that information, did not avail himself of that opportunity, and therefore that portion of the 56F application was denied.
Was there anything in the complaint that was brought by Roche against Edge that suggested liability for anybody other than Edge? The allegations in the complaint appear to be focused on Edge's behavior or their duties and liabilities to Roche.
That is accurate, Justice Hardesty. Edge and the principals of Edge were the only defendants in that underlying Roche action. But that brings me into another.
So do you stipulate that the claims made in the complaint were in fact claims that were made directly at Edge, and as a consequence, the indemnity is being sought for Edge's conduct?
I do. And that's evident from reading what I referred to in our briefing as the underlying complaint. But that brings me to another important issue, and that's this. The claims that are within the scope of the indemnity obligation in the indemnity agreement, of the settlement agreement with the indemnity provision at issue before the court, could only have been the exact type of claims that were included in the allegations within the underlying complaint. Let's think about this. You had co-developers of the W Hotel and Casino. They ran into disagreement. One group left. The respondents were asked to fund $9 million. They were aware of this other group, as was appellants, and they said, the respondents did, we will fund $9 million so we can get this critical piece of property, knowing full well that this other group, the Roche group, had a claim to the right to develop that land. So the only type of claims that could have been brought that are within the scope of the defined indemnity in the agreement at issue were claims by Roche for the malfeasance, if you will, of respondents. There are no other claims that the Roche group, given the underlying circumstances, could bring. So this notion that this court should apply Brown or Rayburn, if the court is to do that, it will render meaningless the indemnity provision that's at issue before the court, because those are the only type of claims that could have been brought by the Roche group. Indeed, they were contemplated. You had two sophisticated parties that negotiated a settlement agreement. They crafted this indemnity provision that's in that settlement agreement, and they identified specific people as potential claimants arising from an historic event, the effort to develop the W Hotel and Casino. So that is a meaningful distinction. If that were not the case, if there were a different set of circumstances, then maybe the language would run afoul. But But let me try and get to what I consider to be an important part of the argument.
But can I pause you there, though, for a moment? If you concede that the contract is unambiguous, then isn't the argument you're just making necessarily introducing extrinsic evidence to explain what that clause means? Therefore, only available to you if you're going to challenge the contract clause as ambiguous?
Not necessarily. There was a memorandum.
Follow that question?
Excuse me?
You follow that question?
I do. And there was a memorandum of understanding that preceded the settlement agreement at issue. Everybody knew what the claims were. Justice Pickering, does the settlement agreement at issue specifically indicate that those parties were co-developers and that everybody was concerned that they would bring the very claims that were identified in the underlying complaint? No, it doesn't say that.
Since the context is what you're saying.
But what else could it be? Because the only relationship between the co-developers and the other parties was this W Hotel and Casino development. Otherwise, they were strangers, and there could be no legal nexus that would give rise to any duty to indemnify. But let's address what I consider to be an important issue here, and that is whether this court should extend Brown and Rayburn to the instant circumstances, specifically extend the express negligence doctrine or rule to the facts of this case. And I would suggest not, because as Justice Pickering, you alluded to or foreshadowed in your concurring opinions in both Brown and Rayburn, there may be circumstances where further inquiry should be undertaken. In other words, the express negligence rule should not apply necessarily, rigidly, to every single instance where the court is to interpret an indemnity obligation. There may be circumstances that are unique, such as this case, where applying that doctrine would be either unjust or inappropriate. I would suggest to this court that because of the specific language, the scope of the indemnity agreement, the fact that it's specific rather than general, as in the Brown and Rayburn cases, that it would be inappropriate to apply it.
Wait. Let me be sure I'm following you. Because the settlement agreement language relating to indemnity is, you're saying, express enough, we don't need to even consider Brown and Rayburn?
No, something slightly different. I think there should be a preliminary inquiry on the part of this court where they look to see the type of agreement at issue.
It's a settlement agreement that's somehow different than the agreement that was at issue in Rayburn?
Absolutely.
Okay, why?
Because the settlement agreement was negotiated by the parties. It's not a services agreement. It's not a contract of adhesion. It's not a form contract. You had two sophisticated parties. You had an arm's length transaction. You had law firms representing them. Unlike in Brown, where you had a form contract that presumably was prepared by lawyers for an insurance company or insurance agency years before and handed to Brown, and it was a take it or leave it situation. He signed it. In Rayburn, you had a residential construction contract.
You're familiar with that.
Right. Which essentially is a form contract. This is a settlement agreement. It's not a contract for services. So my point is the court ought to consider doing this. Make a preliminary inquiry as to the type of agreement at issue in a case, then look specifically to the scope of the indemnity agreement. And if necessary, if there's an ambiguity, look to the underlying circumstances. Now, the court, even where there is an unambiguous agreement, may make reasonable inferences based on the four corners of the document. That's not the same as implying terms. But I would suggest to this court that when one were to look at the settlement agreement and the indemnity obligation, it was quite clear that the only claims that were the subject of the indemnity agreement were the ones that were brought.
But Mr. Schumacher, I'm not so sure that's the case. returning to Justice Pickering's observation about extrinsic evidence, as I understand your agreement, the claims being made against Edge had to do with Edge's conduct and its intentional misconduct as it related to Roche. That is potentially different than claims Roche may have made against the entire venture for having taken advantage of opportunities that it was supposedly deprived of. The point being that even under your analysis, the district court would have to make some assessment as to the intention of the parties and the language that was used if you're going to create an exception to Brown and Rayburn.
I think this court should, I don't know if making an exception is the way that I would couch it, but I do think the court ought not to rigidly apply Brown and Rayburn to every instance where it interprets indemnity provisions. And the court ought to look at the unique circumstances, such as here, where you don't have a general open-ended indemnity agreement. You have one that relates to, it names any claims made by certain individuals, okay? And I would suggest to the court that if one were to read the four corners, the only claims that could be brought by those against Edge would be the exact ones that indeed were contemplated and that ultimately were filed.
So one of the exceptions the court would be looking at then is, as you set out, if it's a settlement agreement negotiated by sophisticated parties on both sides who are represented by counsel, perhaps the district court doesn't need to look any further. Let it go. Let it be.
No, I think the court ought to delve a little deeper and make an inquiry as to whether it is a general, open-ended. The policy behind the express indemnity doctrine was one of unfair surprise to those that typically are in an inferior position to negotiate, such as the insurance broker, such as the subcontractor. Here, there is no risk of unfair surprise given the law firms that were retained and the nature of the business that was engaged in by the litigants. So there ought to be an instance where the policy underlying adopting express negligence doctrine aren't necessarily an issue. Unfair surprise is not what we were dealing with here.
May I ask a question? So, in a sense, is your argument, and I'm recasting it, that the reference to claims by this group was really a shorthand for intentional tort and commercial tort type claims that may be forthcoming from that group, and that everybody to this contract would have understood that reference to be the claims of that nature? In other words, that you really have met the specific policy of that rule?
Well, that's what Judge Kadish found, but she got there a different way. She determined that both Brown and Rayburn had been met because everybody had the claims that were to be the subject of the indemnity had been specifically identified.
Okay.
But to answer your question, Justice Pickering, more directly, I don't know that necessarily, certainly the party litigants in interpreting the indemnity provision would have known that, but I think we also need to look at, when the court looks at it, is it plain and obvious from the words that are printed on the page? And I would suggest that it is. Judge Kadish determined that the claims to be identified were sufficiently detailed. They were the ones that were contemplated, and they were the subject of the scope of indemnity. One point is Halpern and Roche had an arbitration agreement, so that is why the claims were in the underlying action were only against Edge and not also against the other party, if that is a meaningful distinction.
Justice Douglas?
I am still a little bit troubled with, as you're talking in terms of clarity and preciseness, with this issue as to either tender or to consent or involvement as to the party where it talks about defending, hold each other harmless, and so on, that the party who's going to be economically responsible for is just totally out of the picture. They have no participation except to pay the check at the end. And there's some other things that are outside the record, but still, that leads me to some concerns about this, if you're going to hold them to that. And you're saying this was drafted by attorneys, it was very clear, and I'm looking at it and it's not clear as to why they don't either have to tender or at least ask for consent to finalize that duty to defend.
Well, what is clear is that the word tender does not appear in that agreement, and nowhere in that agreement is there such an obligation.
So where do we find the meaning of that word if we're stuck with the four corners of this particular paragraph and this particular agreement?
If either side had intended there be an obligation to tender, they had the means and the intellect to include it. But let me answer your question.
What do we derive their intellect to put it in there if it's not there? Where do we find that?
We don't find it. It's not there. There's no obligation.
How is the court going to draw a conclusion as to the meaning of that? What do we use? A Ouija board? What do we use?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question.
What is the level of interpretation of this phrase? If we don't allow them to have it tended to them, we don't allow them to consent to the final outcome of it, just pay the check, whatever it is.
Well, they have the right, and they did exercise that right at the trial court level to contest
as to the fees, not as to, say, the defense or other issues that were alleged.
Mr. Schumacher, what do you do with the Piedmont case, which seems to suggest that there's an implied duty to tender even in an indemnity clause that doesn't specifically call for tender?
The Piedmont case dealt with joint tortfeasors, which is a meaningful distinction in this context, because this is not a joint tortfeasor situation.
But it could be, depending upon the answer to Justice Pickering's question about how you interpret the language of the settlement agreement. But thank you.
Schumacher, thank you.
Ms. Gorsky, let me give you a total of 3 minutes.
Oh my God.
Give you another minute and a half.
Must be Christmas time.
And it's no guarantee that you're going to be finished in 3 minutes because we're making some questions.
I hope so. 2 points. First, going back to the tender issue that Justice Douglas raised and that Justice Hardesty followed up on, I think the answer to the question is, in fact, the Piedmont case. And I think that the Piedmont case imposes an obligation under law. I recognize it doesn't say tender in the agreement, but if the duty to defend can mean anything, it must mean that the person who's going to be doing the defending and paying all of the costs and fees must have the opportunity to control that defense. And I think that the Piedmont case gives this court that point of law to rely on to hold that in this case.
Ms. Darcy, counsel indicated that we had sophisticated parties and knew what this was about, this agreement, or this clause was based upon that. What is your response to that point?
I think that's absolutely true that these were sophisticated parties. And to borrow language from Justice Pickering's concurrence in the Brown case, if they were so sophisticated and this was all so obvious and everyone knew exactly that these types of claims were the ones that were supposed to be indemnified against, then perhaps they should have said so much more clearly than they did. I think that is the key point here. The Edge keeps telling this court that their agreement, their indemnification clause, is totally different than the one in Rayburn and the one in Brown.
I may be reading a completely different clause than they are because I simply don't see it. I think all of the dispositive points in it are identical. It says any and all claims. Yes, it identifies some of the parties that may be bringing the claims, but that's the only distinction that makes it slightly more specific. And there are other things about the Brown and the Rayburn clauses that make those far, far more specific than this one. The important part, though, is they're not material for this discussion.
So you give no credit whatsoever to the fact that an insurance contract or service contract versus a settlement agreement should in any way distinguish the statement of law that was set forth in both Rayburn and Brown?
That's correct. No distinction whatsoever. What we're talking about is a contract that they have contended repeatedly is unambiguous. And so the parole evidence rule necessarily applies here. And we can't go outside of it. They want to talk to you about what everybody knew leading up to this. Well, it doesn't say that anywhere in the contract. You can't tell what everybody knew when you read the four corners of the contract. And that is what Brown and Rayburn and the express negligence doctrine and the restatement approach, section 22, common F, say. They say you have to be clear. Clarity is the most important thing, and it's the only thing that we can bind parties to.
Mr. Orsi, on the 56F motion, the liability portion of the motion, which the court denied that you brought, what additional facts were you trying to develop before the court eventually grant summary judgment to Edge?
Interestingly, most of those facts that we were trying to develop related to the damages, which, of course, this court doesn't even need to get to because it can reverse based on summary judgment liability, and we don't have to worry about the rest of those orders. Primarily, it was the damages because they were...
Wasn't as to liability?
Not with respect to this issue, no. It was primarily about the attorney's fees that they had incurred and the reason for those.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Grossi. Thank you, Mr. Schumacher. This matter stands submitted.
We'll recess to small team.
All right.